Good morning. I'm Kathy Lentini, the Director of Energy and Marketing Services with PECO, and I will be the session moderator for this morning. I'm thrilled to be here. The support and advancement of women leaders in our community and across the Commonwealth. PECO has been a big supporter of this conference for several years. The conference provides practical tools and great networking opportunities to help inspire women and empower women. How many are here for the first time? Raise your hand. Let's see. Oh my gosh, look at that. Wow. Well, you're in for a treat today. It is a great experience. And thank you for joining us today to talk about why your fluctuating moods are a strength and not a weakness. Interesting, huh? Well, we have a really amazing hour in store for you. I'm excited to introduce Julie Holland, a fellow of New York Academy of Medicine. Dr. Holland was an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine from 1995 to 2012. She is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and Temple University School of Medicine. And we just learned that she spent during her nine years in Philadelphia, she played in a band all across the city and down the Jersey Shore. She's also authored several books, most recently, Moody Bitches, The Truth About Drugs, About the Drugs You're Taking, The Sleep You're Missing, The Sex You're Not Having, and What's Really Making You Crazy. Dr. Holland also runs a private practice in Manhattan and is the medical monitor for clinical research studies on treating post-traumatic stress disorder. Please put your hands together and join me in welcoming Dr. Holland.
Thank you, Kyla. Thank you for that introduction. It's nice to be back in Philly. Did spend a long time here. First of all, I want to congratulate all of you for finding room 103. I'm glad I wore my flats and changed into these because there's no way it would have worked. I don't need to stand by this mic. So, first of all, if anybody wants to move in or move down, you're not going to disturb me if you do that. I want to tell you a little bit about the books that I've published, so that if you have questions. Some people may have questions, and you're like, why are they asking about ecstasy? So I want to tell you about the other books that I published. The first book that I published was I edited. I did not write it entirely. It was written by multiple experts around the world, and I edited a book on the drug ecstasy. It's called Ecstasy, The Complete Guide. And that's a nonprofit book where all proceeds fund clinical research. And more recently, I edited a book about cannabis called The Pot Book, A Complete Guide to Cannabis. That is also a nonprofit book. All proceeds fund clinical research. So the money-making books, I wrote a memoir about my time at Bellevue. I used to run the psychiatric emergency room at Bellevue Hospital. So for 9 years, I worked on Saturday night and Sunday night, and I ran the psych ER at Bellevue. And every time I would go to a party or a dinner or something, and people would say, what do you do? And I said, what I do? And they'd be like, you should write a book. Every time. So I was like, obviously people want to read a book about this. So I wrote a book about it. And then the last book that I wrote is called Moody Bitches. And I'm sorry if that is offensive to you, but it really was just meant to be a joke and to get people's attention, because it takes a lot these days to get people's attention. You have a lot competing for your attention. So the subtitle is The Truth About the Drugs You're Taking, the Sleep You're Missing, the Sex You're Not Having, and What's Really Making You Crazy. So Moody Bitches is really a book that celebrates womanhood and celebrates this idea that we, in general, not maybe every single one of us, but many of us, are naturally dynamic. We are naturally cyclical. We have hormones that ebb and flow, and that is normal. And that actually could be used as one of our biggest advantages. And what's happening in America is that we are being convinced that it is better to be stable, that it is better to be static and not dynamic, that it is better to have less fluctuation in our moods or in our energy level or in how we're feeling about ourselves. And primarily the people currently who are convincing us about that is Big Pharma. One out of four adult women in America is taking psychiatric medications right now. And if one out of four doesn't make you nervous, I will tell you that in pockets around the country, like Manhattan and L.A. and Seattle and Chicago and Salt Lake City, for some reason, the numbers are much higher. The numbers of women who are taking antidepressants, anti-anxiety medicines, sleeping pills, and now the new thing is that women are taking antipsychotics for their depression, and they're taking antipsychotics to help them sleep. And this is a really dangerous road that we are going down. I mean, first of all, it sort of changes our collective diagnosis that the women, as women, who cry and get sad and get scared, we've gone from being labeled as sort of neurotic, where we need anti-anxiety medicines, to now it's psychotic and we need antipsychotics. So I think that the fact that antipsychotics now are like the biggest money makers in big pharma should make everybody very nervous. They've opened up, you know, if you develop a medicine that's used to treat schizophrenia, 1% of the population has schizophrenia. 3 to 5% of the population have bipolar disorder. Half of the population has a uterus. So if you can just kind of broaden your appeal, you've got more customers. And the thing, unfortunately, I want everybody to really keep in mind about medicine in America is that it is a business. You know, because of the way we do healthcare in America, because we don't have national healthcare, because we don't have single party payer, because we don't have, God, I would love one network where I don't have to figure out, you know, what medicine my patient's insurance will pay for, won't pay for, what pharmacy my patient can go to, can't go to, what doctor my patient can go to, can't go to, because of the network. But because we don't have the simplicity of one network and all the pooled data that could come from that network, we have doctors who see patients and get money every time they see a patient. And so, unfortunately, if they prescribe a medicine to you and you need to come back in a month or 2 months for a refill and to check in, you're their customer. You're a steady customer. And the thing about big pharma is they're not necessarily in the business of providing cures. They don't necessarily want to give you something that you take once or twice and then you're, thanks, I'm good, I'm gone. They want something that you're going to take every single day. And if you don't take it, you feel a little weird and funny, and it convinces you that you need it. And this is really what is happening with antidepressants. Something nobody talks about is that antidepressants are hard to get off of. So you go to your therapist, and you've got some problems, and you're complaining, and you're crying a little bit, and they say, I really think maybe you need medicine. Or you go to a psychiatrist, and they say, maybe you need medicine, and they start you on some medicine. And I will promise you, that medicine will make you feel better. I'm not saying it doesn't work. If you take an antidepressant, it will be harder to cry and harder to get pissed off about things, and you will be sort of easier to deal with, and you'll feel better. You may also have trouble climaxing, or it may bother you that you can't cry at appropriate times. But you're going to take that medicine every day, and you're going to continue to feel better. But as soon as you decide, you know what, I don't really need this, and you try to stop it, you're going to feel terrible. And the problem with feeling terrible when you stop it is it makes you think, oh, I really must have a chemical imbalance and I must need this. But what I will tell you is that coming off of medicine is uncomfortable and you need to do it very slowly, and it's better if somebody is helping you, like a psychiatrist or at least an internist who sort of knows what they're doing. You know, 80% of psychiatric medicines in America are prescribed by people who are not psychiatrists, who are not trained in psychiatry. 80% of psych meds in America are prescribed by internists and general practice medicines and family medicine docs and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. And I am not discounting any of the work that these people do, but they didn't get trained like I got trained to figure out whether you really need psychiatric medicines or not. So it is something to keep in mind. There are plenty of good reasons why women are cyclical and dynamic, and it really is primarily based on our hormone fluctuations and the fertility cycle. So what I'm going to talk about for a few minutes is sort of the natural ebb and flow of our hormones and how that affects our how we feel and how we behave. But I will say that if anybody here is taking birth control pills, you're gonna be like, well, that doesn't happen to me. I don't have that. You don't have it because you're not going like this. The birth control pills are giving you steady levels of hormones. And then if you stop it to get your period, which isn't exactly real period, it's really withdrawal bleeding. But if you do stop it, then you may have a few days of feeling a little bit different, but then you get right back on the steady level of hormones. in Moody Bitches, I talk a lot about when you combine antidepressants and oral contraceptives. A lot of women take something for their mood and something so they don't get pregnant. When you combine estrogen and serotonin like that, you get ultra-high levels of very steady, I was going to say satisfaction, but it's not quite that simple. So serotonin, which is the neurotransmitter that is most likely involved with depression. I mean, something to keep in mind is as much as we say we know about the brain and as much as we say, you know, you have a chemical imbalance and, you know, your serotonin is low, it is not that simple. And when you really look at the medical journals and you start actually looking for proof of this chemical imbalance, you're going to come up a little bit empty. There's a great book out now called A Mind of Her Own that really specifically gets into this issue that, you know, there isn't necessarily any real provable low serotonin states that people are talking about. But given that caveat, I am going to talk about serotonin because it's sort of a simple way to bring a lot of things into focus. So the idea of serotonin is that it helps to make you feel satisfied and satiated, like you have enough. Like, it's all good. I don't need anything. So contrast that with the few days before your period when you are not satisfied and things aren't quite right and that isn't enough and you're not doing enough or I'm not doing enough or I'm doing too much and you're doing nothing, which is something I hear a lot in my practice. The few days before your period where your serotonin levels are low and your estrogen levels are low, you're more sensitive. You're less easily satisfied. You're more angsty. You might want something, but you don't know quite what you want. You're a little uncomfortable, and you don't know quite what would make you comfortable. You might eat a lot of carbs and a lot of food to try to soothe yourself and make yourself feel better. You might realize that you're premenstrual and know that you really need a good cry or maybe even a good orgasm to make you feel better. I mean, you know, one thing that I talk about a lot in Moody Bitches is that it's good for you to be aware of your cycle and to know where you are in your cycle, because you're not going to feel the same way every day, and that's normal and it's natural. So that time before your period, you are going to cry more easily, and you are going to get more irritated. But it's an opportunity. You know, I hate to sound all like crunchy granola, and like, it's a beautiful time before your period, and it's an opportunity to, you know, connect with women around the world and know that we're all cycling together, and all of that is really true. You know, I mean, I totally subscribe to this kind of red tent thing that, you know, that women coming together and talking about their blood is a powerful thing. And I would encourage anybody who has a red tent opportunity to do that, because you do sort of unite with other women and feel like, you know, there is something that separates us from men that is uniquely ours. And we could be embracing it instead of rejecting it so much. So this idea that there's a period of time in your cycle where you're a little bit more critical and you can look at things with a more critical eye. And I think that this is useful information. You know, you can't clean if you don't see the dirt, right? I mean, you have to be a little critical so you can look around and say, how can I make this better? And really, PMS is an opportunity every month to be critical and take that criticism seriously. And if you are having fights with your partner that they're not doing enough and you're doing too much, that's true. It's just that the rest of the month, when your estrogen levels are high and your serotonin's higher, you're more accommodating. You're more resilient to stress. You don't get as easily overwhelmed. Something to keep in mind is that estrogen is actually a stress hormone. And when you're stressed, estrogen comes in to calm you down. And it helps you be resilient. And it helps you feel like, I can do that. Sure, give it to me. I can take care of it. No problem. Yes, I'll do it. Sure. That's what happens as your estrogen is going up the whole first half of your cycle. By the time you ovulate, you're feeling pretty confident and powerful. So what I tell my patients is, like, when you're mid-cycle and your estrogen is high and your testosterone peaks a little bit before you're fertile, that's a good time to, you know, agree to take on a big project or do a big project or go in to talk to your boss about a raise or be the boss and build your company up. I don't mean to imply we all have bosses. But keep in mind that there is going to be a crash before your period, and you're going to feel like, why did I take this on? I can't possibly do all of this, and no one is doing as much as I am, and it's probably true. So there's a sort of cycle of, like, accommodation. Estrogen is, to me, I call it the hormone of accommodation, because it's about saying, sure, yes, why not? I'll take care of it, no problem. So keep in mind that on the other side of accommodation is resentment. You know, Why am I doing this? Why aren't you doing this? So you may be having cycles every month of accommodation and resentment, and it's good to sort of keep track of when you're feeling which way. There's a reason why we are so intuitive and sensitive and potentially empathic with people around us is that, you know, because we are... I'm so worried about sounding like sexist and gender specific, so please forgive me. But many of us choose to have children. And because we are the sex, the gender that has children, it behooves us to have sort of special intuitive powers. We need to know when that nonverbal baby is hungry versus fussy versus in pain. You know, we need to be intuitive and empathic so that we can take care of the people around us. And again, to me, this is a strength and not a weakness. It's potentially our sort of biggest secret weapon, is that we are sensitive to what's going on around us. And we will often accuse our male partners of being insensitive. And it may be that testosterone is different from estrogen, and that, you know, we're the ones who are going to be sensitive to what's going on. That's part of our burden, but it's also, you know, part of our power. That not only do we need to know what our nonverbal babies are thinking or feeling, but sometimes we need to know what our nonverbal partners are thinking and feeling. We need to be intuitive about whether we are going to be hit, or our children are going to be abandoned, or whether this person is a good provider and a good partner, and we can pair up with them and build a home together. So the problem with these antidepressants is that they totally sweep away that sensitivity. They sweep away that intuition, and to some degree they sweep away that empathy, that connection. So we're going to lose an important part of ourselves in the process. I mean, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, I'm not saying you're not going to get anything from antidepressants. You are going to get less sensitivity, which for many of us is a relief. You know, the sensitivity can be a burden, and some of us are already sort of oversensitive to begin with. But if we are all medicating away our sensitivities, my biggest fear is that this creates a new normal. I was born in the 60s, grew up in the 70s, and what happened in the 80s was that a lot of women were getting breast implants. And so the women who didn't get breast implants felt flat-chested. And now what's happening is that a lot of women are having synthetic moods. And the ones who aren't medicated are feeling hysterical. So the problem with one out of four women being medicated, and in many cities that number is higher, is it creates a new normal and it snowballs. Where, I mean, I'll have a patient come in. Oh, first of all, you know, when I started my practice, this was back in 95, somebody would come in and they would tell me, you know, I'm crying all the time and I don't know why, or I fall asleep but then I wake up and I can't get back to sleep for hours and I don't understand why. I had people coming into me with symptoms, but they didn't know what to do about it. 10, 20 years later, I have people coming into my office saying, can you explain the difference between Effexor and Wellbutrin? Because, you know, my Pilates instructor was telling me that that's what works for her, but the woman who cleans my teeth said that Zoloft was really bad for her, but then she switched to Effexor and that was better. I mean, that is how my initial consultations are starting these days. It's not a question of, like, what do I need? Do I need medicine? What's wrong with me? It's coming in and saying, which medicine is right for me, which is, you know, because of direct-to-consumer advertising. There's an advertisement for Apple Watch, and it's really evil genius, because right at the beginning of the ad, they show you about 20 different watches. While they're telling you about the watch and how great it is, they're showing you one after another. Look at this one. Look at this one. And so immediately your mind goes from, do I want an Apple Watch? To, oh, which one of these looks better for me? Which one would I like? Which one? And that's what's happening with the flood of direct-to-consumer advertising about antidepressants and antipsychotics. It normalizes it and makes you start to think that you should be picking one. And your friends are taking meds, and they're telling you which is what they liked or which one they tried, and you start thinking you should pick one. So that's a big change that's happened over 20 years in psychiatry. I have many fears about the new normal, but one of my fears about the new normal is what's happening in our offices and in the boardroom. That, again, I don't want to sound crunchy granola, but I am going to talk about yin and yang for a minute because I think it's a little bit easier to think about that than think about women are like this and men are like this, because all of us have yin and yang within us. Yin is traditionally thought of as feminine, but it does not have to be feminine, but it is this sort of receptive energy. It takes things in, and it evaluates, and it thinks about things. It doesn't go out and act. It takes in information. Yin is receptive. Yang is about the archer and going out and getting what you have to get, and it's a penetrative energy. And when I think about yang, I mean, one of the things that I worry about, and I know my husband Jeremy talks about this a lot, is he calls it the cancer of yang, is this idea that in America and around the world, the penetrative energy is what is really revered and what is promoted. So, and you can see it in America. You can see it in, well, what I see is a sort of corporate greed and corporate malignancy, capitalism, sorry, I'm going to talk about capitalism, socialism now. Capitalism is all about unrestricted growth. More, bigger, take it over, make it bigger. You know, in medicine, unrestricted growth is called cancer. So that is why I like to say corporate malignancy, because you need some pruning back. So what I worry about with this new normal in the boardroom is that we lose our sensitivity. We lose that little intuitive something's not right. Something is a little niggling me, and you said something that's making my, spidey senses tingle a bit. You lose the sensitivity to say, well, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe that's wrong. So we need something to balance the yang. I think of this penetrative energy, and I think of, like, bullets and missiles and war and rape. That's all yang. There's too much of that going on in America and around the world, and we need more yin to balance that out. So my fear is, since we're all being convinced that it's bad to be sensitive and receptive and to feel things, and that this cancer of yang is getting even more out of balance. You know, what we need is more yin. I pin a lot of things on Big Pharma because I really feel like, and they've been doing this since the 50s or 60s. If you look at old ads, old psychiatric ads, I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, the pharmaceutical industry would only advertise to the doctors. But there were still women in these ads. And there's like a picture of a woman vacuuming saying, you can get her back up on her feet again if you give her amphetamine, which is very big in the 50s and 60s. They love giving women speed. And the women liked it because it made them feel invincible and like, they can, sure, yeah, I'll do that, no problem, I can do that, sure. So, why wouldn't everybody be happy with women taking speed? But now what Big Pharma is doing, which is very irritating to me, and they've been doing this for a while. Since the 90s, they've been directly advertising to consumers. So now instead of saying to the doctor, well, if you have a patient who's calling you too much and bugging you, you should give her Valium, which I swear to God is an ad from the 50s. It's like, is your patient calling you all the time? Try this. Now they're advertising directly to you. And the newest thing is if you sometimes eat more than you want to and then you feel bad about it, then you may have a new diagnosis, which I was never taught because it doesn't really exist hardly at all, which is called binge eating disorder. But, to advertise directly to women and show a picture of a woman who's like a little overweight and like a little dumpy looking and it's kind of wearing brown and says, if you sometimes eat more than you want to and then you feel bad about it afterwards, you may suffer from binge eating disorder. And this is a medicine that you need. And the medicine that they're selling you is extra long-acting amphetamine. And also very high dose. If I start a patient on, first of all, we need to talk about speed for a minute, because if you look at Big Pharma, there's two things that they're pushing like crazy, making a lot of money off of right now, and that's opiates and speed. I like to call it the Big Pharma speedball. That's where they make their money. So we could talk. I'll talk to you about pain meds in a little bit, but for now I will say that Big Pharma makes a lot of money selling speed. Adderall, Dexedrine, Concerta, Vyvanse. So Vyvanse is losing its patent. It was going to go generic. So the makers of Vyvanse, Shire, decided... I'm sorry, is Shire like a corporate sponsor here? Am I going to get... Is this thing on? No. So So Adderall tablets last like 3 or 4 hours. Adderall capsules last like 6 or 8 hours. Vyvanse lasts 12, 13 hours. But it was losing its patent. So they did a study showing that if they give women high dose of ultra-long-acting amphetamine day after day after day after day, that once you get out to about 10, 11 weeks, it does finally separate out from placebo, saying that it does make women binge less. Now, I could have saved them a few million dollars and told them that if you give a woman high-dose speed that lasts 12 or 13 hours for 10 weeks, she'll probably binge less. So to me, it was like, we know that. But also, they're advertising directly to doctors saying, you may have a patient who's eating more than she wants to and feels bad about it afterwards, which to me is sort of like saying you may have patients who are women. And she may be too embarrassed to tell you that she's eating like that, so you specifically have to ask. And then you can put her on this high-dose amphetamine. So that is my little Vyvanse binge eating disorder rant. It's very aggravating to me when I see things like this happen. There's also, you know, the idea that antipsychotics are now being prescribed for depression. That they're saying, you know, if you don't respond to your antidepressant, you can add an antipsychotic onto that. And the truth is that, again, these do help make you feel better. They're very hard to come off of. And antipsychotics have irreversible side effects. So you can go on the antipsychotic and feel better and go off, but you may still have diabetes or an irreversible movement disorder as a parting gift, even if you've decided that you don't want to keep staying with the antipsychotic. So I just want to come back to the central sort of message here, which is that it's okay to feel your feelings, and that being in touch with how you actually feel instead of trying to push it down is what in the long run is going to be a lot healthier for you. Repressing anger, repressing need, fear, sadness, those things are not only going to make you sort of psychiatrically uncomfortable or psychiatrically ill, but they're going to make you physically ill. There's a great book called When the Body Says No by Gabor Mate, who's a wonderful writer and really brilliant guy who just lays out all the science. To this, intuitively, this makes sense to us, right? Like this idea that if you are repressing everything, you're going to get sick. Like we sort of know it, but there's a book full of scientific studies sort of proving that, yes, this is a real thing. That, you know, autoimmune diseases and fibromyalgia and aches and pains or even cancer. I mean, there's strong evidence for some things and moderate evidence for other things. But I think it's fair to say that if you repress, you are not going to feel well. And I just read an article a couple weeks ago about repressing and not being in touch with your feelings that causes binging and obesity and just being overweight in general. I mean, people soothe themselves with food. And, I mean, this is getting back to what I was saying about PMS, that it's really common to sort of binge on carbs to try to make yourself feel better before your period. And if you're very stressed out and you're not feeling your stress and you're saying everything's fine, you may end up overweight and binging. when I was growing up in the 70s, we had a lot of blacklight posters. We had you had blacklight rooms and the posters would kind of light up and they were very groovy and they had velvet on them. And I know not that many people in here know what I'm talking about, but some of you remember. So there was a 70s poster that was trying to define stress. And it says something like the discomfort your body feels when you're struggling not to choke someone who totally deserves it. I think there may have been a swear in there that I took out. But it's this idea that you're not doing what you genuinely feel like you should be doing. And, you know, whether that is chewing out somebody at work who is behaving very badly or giving your partner a hard time because they let you down with something or yelling at your kids because they scared you. Keeping all this stuff in causes stress, and stress causes inflammation. And when I was writing Moody Bitches, I gave myself like a chapter a month pretty much. I would write a chapter. In February, I would be writing about what I read about in January, but I would be reading about what I was going to write about in March. And every month, I kind of moved forward to the next thing. But when I started learning about inflammation, I needed 3 months to read and write and process what I'd learned. And it's actually the shortest chapter in the book because the publishers were like, this is boring, this is wonky, nobody cares about this. But I really care about this stuff. Stress causes inflammation. Chronic inflammation is a setting for cancer. It is a setting for obesity, for insomnia, for depression. There's tons and tons of medical research supporting the idea that inflammation is connected to depression, and inflammation is connected to anxiety, and it's connected to insomnia, and it's connected to obesity. So if you want to feel better, you need to do things that decrease stress and decrease inflammation. And I, in my private practice, I really encourage my patients to follow an anti-inflammatory diet. Andy Weil, sort of the father of complementary alternative medicine, he's got a great website, drweil.com, and he explains anti-inflammatory diet very well. And I ask my patients to spend some time looking at that food pyramid because I think that that's a good one to follow for your brain. There's a real gut-brain connection, and when your body is inflamed, your stomach is inflamed, your digestion affects your brain. How you digest affects your neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are made to some degree in your stomach, and they're also made in your brain, but they cannot be made unless they have the proper nutrients and ingredients, and those can't get to the brain if you have inflammation. So if you have lactose intolerance, stop eating dairy. I encourage my patients to cut out everything white, basically. I'm just like, be a racist. White flour, white sugar, rice, potatoes, bread, pasta, starch. All that starchy stuff gums up the works, adds to inflammation, makes your brain not work as well. So if you're going to make any dietary changes, try to just cut out white food. Flour and sugar, if you can just cut out flour and sugar, and I'm saying just like it's easy, it's not easy. I know, I mean, I wrote about this in Moody Bitches also, that like bread and pasta gets you high, it gets you stoned, right? It does. There are literally components of gluten that activate the opiate receptors. I'm not kidding when I say that bread gets you high. I know bread gets you high, and it's hard to quit bread. But it is easier to quit bread than stopping smoking cigarettes or cutting out heroin, so I know it's doable. And the truth is, when it comes to cutting out flour and sugar, the easiest thing to do is to just stop. Because as soon as you stop eating sugar, you stop craving sugar. It's really true. So the problem with white flour, two things. One is it's inflammatory for a lot of people, meaning that they get inflammation from eating flour. But the other thing is that your body pretty much processes white flour as if it were white sugar. You get the insulin surge from your pancreas, which you do not want. So you want nice, stable blood sugar levels. And the way to have stable blood sugar levels is to not have sugar. I mean, you guys have all heard about you eat sugar, then the insulin comes up, and then you crash, and then you want more sugar, you know, and it's da-da-da. And, like, while I'm all for some natural fluidity and cyclicity, I am not when it comes to sugar. You want very stable blood sugar levels. That's what's best for your brain. Your brain actually does really well with fat. It doesn't need sugar. I know you get, like, a little boost when you have, you know, chocolate in the afternoon, but you would likely get that same boost if you had, like, half an avocado. So anti-inflammatory diet, anti-inflammatory activities. Exercise is anti-inflammatory. Meditation, mindfulness, breathing, all anti-inflammatory. Quick tip if you're anxious, in and out left nostril only. It's called left nostril breathing. You don't have to alternate because that makes me impatient and then I get more anxious. Just plug up your right nostril. And you can do this at like a board meeting when some jerk is talking. In and out, left nostril, 8-10 breaths. I guarantee you, you're going to feel as good as if you took like a little bit of Xanax. So you don't necessarily need meds. Anxiety can be really quickly controlled with breath. Just plug up your right nostril, breathe in and out through your left. That will calm you down 9 times out of 10. I just got a call from a patient this morning who's been really anxious lately and having a lot of stress. And this morning she called me, and I really really think she's having a heart attack. I mean, she had, you know, she's like, I feel like someone is sitting on my chest. It's really tight. I can't breathe. I'm like, okay, you've gone from panic to like, you need to go to an ER. Women get heart attacks a lot, and not many of us really think about it. I mean, everyone talks about breast cancer, and I'm not discounting the pink ribbons, but the thing that really kills women is heart disease, is heart attacks. And for women, much more than men, the thing that causes heart attacks are emotional incidents. It's not exertion. It's emotions. It's stress. It's keeping everything in and repression. This is a major cause of heart attacks. So I do PTSD research and post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, I work primarily with the research I'm doing is primarily with veterans. We're looking at MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, which is ecstasy therapy for veterans, which, I mean, I can talk about MDMA for an hour, so I won't, except to say that you could not design a better medicine to help catalyze psychotherapy and make the psychotherapy go deeper and faster and get to where you need to go and take care of business. So that's some research that we're doing. The other study that I'm doing is a cannabis study to see if certain strains of cannabis may be helpful for treating post-traumatic stress disorder. So I do want to talk about pot for just a second. I'm sorry if you have no interest in it, but cannabis is an anti-inflammatory medicine, and one of the main messages of Moody Bitches is that you need to do things that are anti-inflammatory. So I do end up talking quite a bit about pot and Moody Bitches because it is an anti-inflammatory medicine, and there is a way to utilize cannabis without getting stoned for those of you who are interested in just the anti-inflammatory effects. You can get that from a component called CBD, which stands for cannabidiol. It's a Charlie Bravo Delta, CBD. I encourage people to Google CBD and learn more about CBD because you will be hearing more about it now that you just heard me say that. And one thing I will say about this sort of medical cannabis and legalization issues, and then I will not, because again, I could talk for an hour about pot. The people who are bankrolling and funding against pot being legal and pot being medicinal, anybody want to guess where most of the money's coming from? Totally big pharma, right? Because, like, I have a patient with rheumatoid arthritis. She takes a lot of pain meds. She takes a lot of anti-inflammatories. Now her kidneys are falling apart because of all the meds she's taking. She really needs a pain medicine that is anti-inflammatory. Anybody know what that might be? Oh, cannabis. Right. So big pharma, and particularly a company that is making fentanyl and synthetic THC called Insys, they just gave $500,000 to fight the initiative in Florida. So, you know, follow the money. I think that I really do believe that cannabis is medicine. I know that it is a potent anti-inflammatory medicinal herb that has been used for thousands of years, and it's really only in the last 100 years that it was made illegal for very sort of xenophobic, racist, corporate greed-based reasons. Okay, a couple quick things. I want to talk about something called partial intermittent reinforcement. This is important. If you put a mouse in a cage and they press a lever, and every time they press a lever, they get food, they'll press a lever, they get food, press a lever, food, everybody's happy. Or you could have them press a lever and they never get food, and eventually they're like, all right, this isn't working, and they walk away. But if they press a lever and sometimes they get food, and sometimes they don't get food, they will never leave that lever. They will always press it because, hey, you never know. Got to be in it to win it. You know, I got to hang out here. Maybe I'll get something. This is what people do in relationships. That you got something a little bit in the beginning, or you sometimes got something, or and this is what happens with drugs. Well, the first few times I took it, it felt great. I'm going to keep doing it and hope that it still feels great. So keep in mind that partial intermittent reinforcement is the cornerstone of addiction. And we are absolutely 100% addicted to our cell phones. I know this in my core, that, you know, we get a little bit of what we need through these phones, and we feel a little bit of a sense of connection on Facebook and a sense of efficiency with email and texting. And we're social creatures, and we really require feeling like we're connected socially. But the thing is that everybody's forgetting is that what we also require is eye contact and grooming and taking in somebody's, please God forgive me for saying this, aura. And taking in somebody's scent. You know, we, our mate selection is totally based on pheromones. And how someone smells to us helps us figure out whether we would have healthy children together. The way that somebody smells has a lot to do with their genetic compatibility. I know that seems crazy to you, right? Like, but the same basis for kidney transplants and are you a good match is what is used with pheromones and figuring out whether somebody's a good match. So when I have a patient come in and start telling me about her new boyfriend, one of the first things I ask is, like, do you like the way he smells? I don't mean his cologne. I mean, like, could you live in his armpit? And you know, I mean, I will usually hear a resounding yes. And then I know, okay, well, you guys should hang out and see how it goes because you're good. When you are on the pill, you do not process pheromones accurately. And there have been multiple studies showing that when you are on oral contraceptives, you do not select a mate appropriately because you cannot access that pheromone system. So you end up with somebody who is genetically similar. See, what you want, like, oh, I'm immune to these five things, and my husband is immune to these five things, so our kids are going to be immune to 10 things. That's great. But when you're on the pill, you don't end up with 10, you end up with 5. You end up with somebody who's genetically too similar. And what, you know, what the research says is you end up with somebody more like a brother than an other. So what I tell my patients is you really want to be off the pill when you're looking for a mate. I mean, if you're like in your 20s and screwing around and, you know, use condoms, great, that's fine. But like if you're really ready to find like, you know, a daddy for your kids, you really should be off the pill. And I understand that's inconvenient, but I do think that it's important for mate selection. The last thing I want to just mention quickly is authenticity. I think that people really resonate with authenticity. And this is one of the things I worry about. When you're medicated, you know, you don't smile as much. You don't cry, but you don't frown. You also don't get as elated or as excited. I mean, you are a muted version of yourself emotionally. People resonate with authenticity, and I don't necessarily want to totally get into politics, but I'm thinking this may be one of the reasons why some people like Donald Trump is because, well, he speaks his mind. He says, you know, he says what he feels. He says what he thinks. And that's maybe the only thing that I could say good about Donald Trump. But I think that people do resonate with that kind of authenticity, you know, that he's like, it's no BS. And one of the things I worry about with Hillary is everyone keeps saying, like, she needs to smile more. Oh, not too much, though. You know, she needs to be happy. Oh, but don't do that. That's crazy, you know. Or like, well, you know, I want to know there's a real person there. Oh, but don't cry in New Hampshire because now you're crying. So it's very it's a hard line for women to walk. You know, we want to live our best selves and be authentic, but people get freaked out when you express too much emotion. So I understand the drive to take something so that you're less emotional, but I would just encourage you that you're potentially giving away, you know, one of the best parts of yourself. All right, I'm going to wrap it up because the other little things I have are too random and they just won't fit in. But we'll see. I love Q&A. I'm happy to answer any questions about... I know a lot about psychedelic drugs and other drugs. I don't think that's really this crowd. But, you know, or maybe later it is today. I don't know. But I'm happy to just answer any questions. If you have, like, personal questions about your medicines and which is better or something, come see me at the book signing because that's too personal. Okay.
Thank you very much. Very interesting and insightful. Wow. I'm going to try this now.
Right.
It's working. It's working. Okay. We'd love to take some questions. If you have questions, please go to the mics in the center so that we can answer some questions.
And if you don't, I'll just keep yakking, so don't worry about it. I will talk about one thing while you guys are coming up. Never mind. Go right ahead. It's like, I get something.
First of all, fabulous.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I have been on, like, birth control for so many years, and I'm off. And so this up-down cycle thing, I'm still trying to get used to. So it's fabulous to hear. And all about the estrogen that you've been talking about. One of my questions is, how much do you know about, like, say, when you have to take estrogen blockers, like tamoxifen or something? Like, is that
right,
going to affect your mood swings?
Yes.
Like,
oh,
that?
My gosh, yes. Yeah. No, I had a patient who came to me, had never had any psychiatric issues, but when she was on tamoxifen, she really needed antidepressants. So they can... look, if you need to take tamoxifen, it's because you're trying not to die from cancer. So I don't want to dissuade anyone from taking them. I think they're important. And my mom's cousin stopped it because it was bothering her stomach, and then she died of cancer. And it was like, she didn't want to tell her doctor. But yeah, you can get depressed It does sort of throw you into a menopause. There's a whole chapter in Moody Bitches about menopause, by the way. It's called The Storm Before the Calm, because things get kind of hairy and crazy. From like 40 to 55, expect that things are going to get like more roller coastery. Like if you are naturally cycling, you're going to have bigger peaks, bigger valleys. And you have to let people know, like you have to at least let your partner know, look, there's going to be a couple days out of the month where I'm so into you and so committed to you and I want to be your wife. And there's going to be a couple days out of the month where I'm a little more interested in like who your friend is. Because when that testosterone peaks, testosterone is about novelty. It's not about commitment. So it's normal in the course of your cycling that you go from feeling intimate with your partner to feeling horny for strangers to then feeling not very interested in sex at all. And that's normal. But you have to communicate. First, you have to realize it yourself and be honest with yourself about how you're feeling. And then you have to calmly communicate it to your partner. But perimenopause, 7 to 14 year stretch, where you are on like a roller coaster and it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. But tamoxifen will throw you into that state acutely.
Okay, over there, please.
Hi, I just had a quick question in regards to the term when you say oral contraceptives and the pill. How does it apply to IUDs? Is it the same?
Really good question. IUDs are much less, it's a better way to go. First of all, there's non-hormonal IUDs, and then there's hormonal IUDs. But even the hormonal ones, you're getting sort of the hormones right where you need it instead of everywhere. You know, your brain has got a ton of estrogen receptors. When you take it orally, it goes everywhere. With IUD, it's much more localized, so you are exposed to lower levels. Non-hormonal IUDs are great. There was something called a cervical cap. You can't find a cervical cap or a diaphragm to save your life now. It's like they don't exist anymore. But the cervical cap was an amazing thing because it was contraception and it was a diva cup. It was a little tiny rubber. If anyone here is using diva cups, good, do it. I think they're great. I think, less landfill is a good thing. But you can use a cervical cap like a diva cup for menstrual fluid, and they cost about $20 and they last about 20 years. I mean, very cost effective. So I prefer non-hormonal contraception if you can do it, but the hormonal IUD is very popular, and if you ask most OB-GYNs what they use, that's what they use on themselves.
Thank you.
Okay, over here, please.
You spoke about CBD. Is that in relation, correlation with hemp oil?
Yeah,
and
yes.
As far as blood testing, how does that come up in a blood test? Say, you know, an employer finds out you're taking hemp oil or...
Good question.
And how is the best way to ingest?
Okay, so first of all, if you are being drug tested, they're not always going to test for cannabis. It depends who's testing. If it's a medical insurance company, they almost never test for cannabis because those things, cannabis doesn't affect actuarial tables. Cannabis doesn't kill you, doesn't make you crash your car. So the insurance companies, if it's at work and you're peeing in a cup, the common things they're looking for are nicotine, because half of cigarette smokers die, and that's expensive. And cocaine, because people who use cocaine have heart attacks and strokes. And they look for blood pressure medicine, because they want to know if you're faking a low pressure, okay? So you're not always being tested for cannabis. But if you are being tested for cannabis, CBD doesn't typically trigger a positive test, because they're usually looking for THC, which is the component of pot that gets you high. And hemp oil is a CBD-rich oil. Yeah.
How is the best way to get the benefits?
Well, the thing about CBD, let's say you've got arthritis, you can just rub it on your joints. You can use it topically. You could take it orally. There are pills. There's suppositories. There's creams. There's a lot of different ways to go. Bluebird Botanicals, I think, is a really reliable company that I trust, and Mary's Medicinals is another company that I trust for CBD products. There's a lot of CBD products out there that are coming from China. And the problem with hemp is it's something called a bioaccumulator. It can take in a lot of... cannabis is really good for the soil. It puts in nitrogen and it takes out impurities and pesticides. So the problem is, because it takes out things, the stuff that's coming from China is really full of pesticides and, you know, bad chemicals you don't want in your body. So Mary's Medicinals and Bluebird Botanicals are CBD sources that I tell my patients about.
Hi, just a comment and a quick question. You're so right about the inflammation. I stopped all sugar and white flour for a long time, and all the pain in my legs and my arms disappeared. I thought I had fibromyalgia.
Right.
Then I actually fell off the wagon for a little while. And guess what's back?
Right.
So I just have to thank you because you've inspired me. You know, I really needed to hear somebody tell me where it's coming from.
I fell off the wagon too. I went to Italy and like you... Forget it. I mean, I was surprised they had gluten-free products there, but I ended up having a lot of bread and pasta, and I was amazed at how quickly this came back, and my skin got, like, weird stuff on it, and I'm sorry to gross out a few people in the audience, but I actually got a yeast infection. It was, like, so much sugar and flour all of a sudden that my whole body was like, what are you doing? So once, you know how people complain that if you go on low carb, oh, yeah, it's great, but as soon as you go back on the carbs, you gain weight. Guess what? It's because you're not supposed to go back on the carbs. It's like, yeah, that diet works great until you... Don't do the until part. You know, we are designed for protein and vegetables primarily. Fruit should be eaten seasonally. It's not natural to eat mangoes in February, you know? So, like, if you stick with what's local and what's in season when it comes to fruit, and then just have all the protein and vegetables you want, you're going to be in really good shape, like, physically and... brain-wise, I don't want to say mentally, because it really is a brain thing. What you eat, you know, when I start talking to my patients and say, like, what did you have for breakfast? What do you eat for lunch? Every one of my patients is the same thing. You know, no doctor ever asked me what I eat. Really? Like, you know, nobody wants to know what kind of fuel you're putting in the machine and, like, it's getting gunked up. Do you want to, don't you want to know? So good for you for sticking to it, because I know it's hard, but it's doable. The bacon makes up. No, I'm sorry. I mean, if you're anti-inflammatory, you're really not supposed to be having like a lot of steak and bacon. You're supposed to be like having, you know, lean proteins. But if you do like a paleo, then I will tell you that the bacon makes up for the bread. It all evens out.
Good morning, Dr. Holland.
Hi.
First of all, I'll tell you, you look great in brown.
Oh, thank you.
Secondly, I actually have two questions. The first, you mentioned antipsychotic have irreversible side effects. Do you see those same irreversible side effects with antidepressants?
No. Okay. No. Antipsychotics, diabetes, metabolic issues, right? Like high blood sugar and irreversible movement disorders, tardive dyskinesia. And you don't see those with antidepressants.
And can I ask a second one? It's a quick one. The second one is you mentioned some risks to being on both birth control and antidepressants. At the same time, what do you see as the greatest risk?
Well, the greatest risk is that you've got ultra high, unnatural levels of estrogen and serotonin because they're yoked together, and usually they both ebb and flow. But when you're taking antidepressants and oral contraceptives, then you have unnaturally elevated levels of both of them. So it's like a special version of Teflon, like nothing's going to touch you. And
even
I understand that is appealing. What?
Even at low doses.
Look, you know, I should have prefaced this. Please call in back, everyone who's living. No, I should have prefaced this by saying, I understand that some people really need their medicines. I should have said this much earlier. Look, I'm a psychiatrist. I worked at Bellevue. I get that some people are very sick and need their psych meds. And I don't mean to tell everybody, you don't need this. Go off them. If you need it, you need it. But do keep in mind that combining antidepressants and oral contraceptives is going to give you a very unnatural state that most people don't have all the time, which is steady levels of both of them.
I just wanted to make sure there's nobody over there. So I work in a department that is very female. And
good.
I am the only postmenopausal. So what's the difference mood-wise with
right.
a postmenopausal?
So I'm waiting personally to find out because I would. That's like the next book. I would like to talk about the calm after the storm and what to expect. Because, and also remember I was saying like, you know, sometimes like I'm in love with my husband or I'm horny and then I'm not at all. Like, so what happens when this stops? Where am I going to end up? When I'm like this, am I still going to be attracted to my husband? We're waiting to find out. What I can tell you is... you know, there's less cyclicity. When everything finally dies out and you're not having hot flashes, you're not having night sweats, and you're not bleeding anymore, there is much less cyclicity. There is more of a flat line that is what people are trying to get from antidepressants and oral contraceptives. Now, where your flat line is, I can't say. I mean, I'm very curious to see where I end up. And so is my husband. It's less stormy. Some women end up a little bit under and a little depressed, and some women really aren't libidinous. They're not horny, and they need like a little bit of testosterone. I write a lot about testosterone and oxytocin in Moody Bitches. Those are my favorites. but where are you? Where are you on the flat line compared to where you are before?
I don't think I changed much, but I'll have to check with my children and my husband.
Yeah. You know, one thing I will say about perimenopausal time for a lot of women, I interviewed a lot of OB-GYNs before I wrote this perimenopause chapter, and the thing I heard a lot was anger. Women, my patients are angry. The women are angry. And I'm definitely seeing this with my husband, too. Like, I'm much quicker to sort of blow up and yell at people than I ever used to be. You know, estrogen really keeps you kind of calm, and it's okay, whatever. It's like everything is like, you know, water off a duck's back. When that estrogen starts to wane, everything's not okay, damn it. You know, so we have to, I mean, this is why it's good to do mindfulness and meditation and things that help to improve sort of impulse control so that you don't blow up at someone.
You've mentioned not repressing emotions and being more free with them. And when that comes to, you know, anger and stress and things like that, obviously those have a tremendous impact on the body. Can you speak a little bit more to kind of embracing those natural cycles? You had mentioned exercise and meditation, but other healthy ways of processing?
Yeah, well, look, the biggest thing that I can tell everybody is that you need to be in your body to feel your feelings. Okay? If you're on your phone, you're not in your body. You're elsewhere. Like, you actually need to be present to feel your feelings. And you have to feel your feelings in order to communicate your wants and needs. So, number one is put your phone down. And number two is be in your body and sort of breathe and scan your body and see how you're feeling. And then calmly convey that to someone else, or at least just start with writing it down. But I think a lot of us don't even know how we feel. Yeah, I remember when I was working at Bellevue, I finally had time to go into therapy, and my therapist would be like, well, how did that make you feel? And I'd be like, I don't know. How do you feel now? I don't know. You know, I didn't realize it, but I'm like so other-oriented. I'm so making sure everybody else has what they need. You know, and you know, like when you have little kids and everybody's got like their lunchbox and then you run off to work and I'm like, oh, I didn't brush my teeth. You know, it's just like I didn't take care of me. So, you know, we have to sort of make time and space. And that's why people talk about mindfulness or meditation, because you don't have your phone and you can actually feel for a minute what's going on. And, you know, and cardio can be good for that, too. You know, if you go running or swimming or something and you don't have any devices with you to distract you, you can actually process things. It takes a little bit to think and feel and figure out what you're feeling. So the biggest advice I can give you is just like be in your body and be present so that you can actually feel your feelings and take care of them instead of just staying busy and staying elsewhere and not, you know, not dealing with what's really going on.
Okay, we have time for one more.
Yes. Good morning, doctor.
Hey.
My question is about menopause. What do you think about hormone replacement therapy?
Right.
That whole piece?
So, very complicated question. I tried to cover it in the book as well as I could, but even after I wrote a whole book on it, I still had people asking me, so what is your opinion about it? Like, you laid it all out, but what do you think? I mean, it's very individual. People have to really talk with somebody, a physician, who understands what your particular risks are. You know, if you're a cigarette smoker, it's riskier to be on estrogen. If you've got a lot of breast cancer in your family, it's riskier to be on estrogen. But for most women, it's better to be on natural estrogens, on what are called bioidentical, not bioequivalent. Bioequivalent is a scam to make you think that those synthetics are bioidentical, okay? Bioidentical hormones, they're not synthetic. A lot of the research showing that these hormones are bad for you were given to women who were in their 70s, and they gave them synthetic progestin. The synthetic hormones are really lousy. Synthetic progesterone in particular makes you very depressed. That's why some people get very depressed on the pill. So if at all possible, you want natural, not synthetic. I also think that there are some herbal things that can be very helpful if you don't want to take hormones. Like if you have hot flashes and night sweats, you can take black cohosh. There is tons of evidence showing that black cohosh works for sweats and hot flashes, and you don't necessarily need to take hormones. There's also a root from the Andes that's called maca, M-A-C-A, which is great if you're very dry and you need lubrication. Maca is a great way to go. I also love coconut oil and talk about it a lot in the book. Maca will not only help with lubrication, but it will help with libido and quality of orgasm. One of the things nobody tells you about perimenopause is that your orgasms get dinky and terrible, and even if you worked hard to get to one, you don't feel very rewarded. Maca can really help with that. So, and some women just need estrogen. Some women just need progesterone. Some women really just need testosterone. So it's good to work with somebody who can take your blood levels.
Yeah, now what I'm referring to, like, is more energy, more as far as weight loss and fogginess and moodiness.
Fogginess, estrogen's going to help you for sure. And moodiness, I think estrogen can go either way. You know, sometimes it makes women very weepy and sensitive, and they don't like that. For energy, I think the best thing you can do is just totally scrap whatever diet you're on and eat protein and vegetables primarily at every meal. And, you know, testosterone can do a lot for libido and for energy, but a lot of doctors aren't comfortable prescribing it.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, everyone. Dr. Holland will be in the exhibit hall for those of you who had more questions. She will be signing her book. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the day.